From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Kendall Wilcox decided to go public with the fact that he was gay, he knew things would get complicated. The twist in his story was the fact that he worked for the LDS Church, in fact, taught at Brigham Young University, and he intended to stay there. But last month, BYU fired Wilcox, though they said it had nothing to do with his sexuality or that he had become outspoken about it. In fact, Wilcox himself hasn't accused the church as a whole of homophobia, though he does wonder if it wasn't an issue with some of his co-workers or managers. Again, it's complicated. Today in the program, Kendall Wilcox is joining us to give us an update on his situation and to talk about the reason he came out in the first place to create a film and a dialogue about homosexuality and Mormonism. We'll talk about what he's learning and hearing from those caught in the middle after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last summer, we had on the program the filmmaker and television producer Kendall Wilcox. His story was making news because he chose to come out as being gay and yet planned on staying put as a senior producer for BYU TV. That's what made his story so novel. Wilcox worked for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he went out of his way to say he was being treated with respect. Wilcox is in the process of producing a film, and what he really wanted to do was change the conversation about Mormonism and homosexuality. He wanted to explore the way people talk about the issue or argue about the issue. Well, last month, Kendall Wilcox was fired from BYU, though the institution has said it had nothing to do with his sexuality or that he had become outspoken about it. Today in the program, Kendall Wilcox is joining us to update his story, to talk about the reason he came out in the first place to create this film and this dialogue. We'll talk about what he's hearing and learning from those who are caught in the middle of this story. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Kendall Wilcox is now an independent filmmaker, worked for nearly 14 years, though, as a producer for BYU TV until, as we said, he was fired last month. His current film project is called Far Between. We should also say he's spearheading the Empathy First initiative. It's aimed at changing the tone of public discourse on divisive social issues. And Kendall Wilcox, welcome back.
Thank you very much
for
having me.
Thanks for being with us. Mm-hmm. Well, let's begin with the first part of the story, of course, that you were terminated as of November 11th from Brigham Young University. And I guess here's the important question. Was it because you were gay?
No, I do not believe so. I don't see it as an act of direct or institutionalized homophobia, like I've said before. It was really a function of an impasse between me and management and the management styles that were have been in place for a while. Things got a little bit more acute in terms of the problems.
What do you mean, after you came out?
After I came out, yeah. Which sort of eventually brought it to a head. Basically, there have been others who have left the institution. We'll just say that. They have left the institution because of these exact same problems with management. Certain management
who
styles.
Who weren't gay.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because that's – so, wait. Are you saying that it had nothing to do with the fact that you were gay?
I know I cannot speak directly and specifically about the hearts of the individuals who decided to let me go.
Sure.
I know that. But there is no evidence, I'll say – to indicate that there's any sort of direct homophobia at play here, to the degree where I think it is, it does behoove me to be as direct as possible in saying I do not see it as such, and I don't see it as being helpful to me or the conversation or to the community and how we're addressing this issue to even allow for it to be even a hint of it to be homophobic.
You don't want to rely on that crutch. You don't want it to be suggested
not.
That's okay. Well, but look, they said that about you, that you didn't show up to work, that you didn't communicate with your supervisor. I mean,
right.
That's
I find that unfortunate on their part that they chose to categorize in that way, because that's demonstratively inaccurate. I did show up to work. I mean, even it's provable by the work product that I was turning in, by I have witnesses of fellow employees. I was on assignment at the behest of my direct supervisor, on assignment on a project that was being produced out of house, and so I spent the majority of my time on the road at offices here in Salt Lake rather than down in Provo, in 8 to 10 hour, 12 hour meetings on the road filming. And there's even security records in the building, you know, in terms of, you know, my identity card going in and out. So demonstrably false. I can't speak to why they categorized it in that way.
But, so why did they fire you? Creative differences? That's often the term you hear.
Yeah. I actually can't answer that. I mean, there's.
But if you can't answer that, then how can you say it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that not only are you gay, you're outspoken about the fact that you're gay?
Mm-hmm. It's a fair question. But again, I say there's no evidence.
Okay.
There's no evidence. And so it's purely speculation. And if that's all we can rely on, I don't see that being helpful to anybody to take it there. Because obviously it became a flashpoint for a lot of people who directly went there. And I am not in denial of the reasons why people go there. For obvious, clear reasons, given the history of the institution on this issue. But since there is no evidence, and I am saying it isn't, I do not take it there. I would hope nobody else takes it there.
Do you think the real problem wasn't so much the fact that you're gay, but and the fact that you were open about that fact, but that you are open about the fact that you're not critical about the church and its relationship with gay people?
No.
But you've opened up the church to what I would think they would regard as kind of unwelcome scrutiny about an issue. Do you think that had something to do with it?
Sure. We're all aware that the church at times is uncomfortable in talking about this issue given its history and given its current position as well.
Did anyone ever say that to you, by the way? Kendall, we don't want you speaking out openly. This
no.
damages the reputation of the church.
Absolutely not.
Really?
There was caution in the tone of certain questions and in my interactions with administration at BYU.
Yeah.
Hesitancy and so on, reticence. But no, out and out, don't talk about this. Be careful where you go. You know, they didn't even say something like that.
Isn't this interesting that this is happening? The thing that, even though it's happening to you,
mm-hmm.
that it's such an example of the way this dialogue plays out.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like a microcosm of exactly what you're getting at, because
mm-hmm.
now you're getting this reaction, and I'm guessing you're used to it by now. This Wilcox guy is in denial about this issue.
Exactly.
The other thing, you know, all of these different sides, it must be really, if not, I'm sure it's painful and difficult, but it's also must be incredibly fascinating for you on some levels.
Absolutely. At moments, it's a little disheartening, frankly, a little confusing, where force me to sort of call into question issues of self-awareness and how am I reading, you know, culture and my specific situation accurately. But then in my moments of lucidity, I realize, no, this is exactly why this documentary exists, the overall project exists, why we're trying to re-engage this dialogue that's been in place for decades, obviously, but trying to re-engage it in different ways and then call into question issues like this. How what is this thing called homophobia? How does it play out in our particular community and culture? How is it helpful to point it out, and when is it absolutely unhelpful? It's counterproductive.
Well, okay, so let's talk about this particular case of you being fired as one of those examples of. I'm guessing what your conclusion is that in this case, it's not helpful for me to say to blame it on homophobia
mm-hmm. because it's not true.
Because it's not homophobia.
Exactly. Primarily. Yeah,
primarily, at least you think.
Right.
But isn't this what's so interesting about homophobia? And isn't this what's interesting about what you have been exploring?
Mm-hmm.
Is that these things are textured, they're layered, they're deeply embedded.
Mm-hmm.
They are related in some ways to our cultural opinions.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to say, no, I don't have any evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what is homophobia then if it's not... What is it? I mean, what
exactly.
kind of insights has it given you about homophobia, what it is?
Well, there's a major reaction from a lot of people that may consider themselves maybe more on the conservative end of this apparent spectrum,
yeah.
Who just say, you know, how dare you take it to homophobia? They get very specific and technical in saying homophobia is a fear of homosexuals or homosexuality. We're not afraid of it. We're just... morally against the behavior.
Right.
And so please don't take us there, because then it borders on just name calling and calling us bigots. And that's reducing us down to just a word and a category rather than the reality of the texture behind who we are, why we feel what we feel, what we believe. And which that sort of a conversation, I think, is extremely helpful. That's where we're trying to take it, is into, okay, well, then who are the human beings who are expressing their feelings and beliefs about homosexuality that may be categorized as homophobic, but in the end, it's not. I agree with them. It's not. They aren't necessarily afraid. I can't say categorically across the board, but it's not that they're afraid. They just have moral issues with it and against it, or also they may frankly be ignorant. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. They're just uninformed, and that's we're all uninformed to some degree. So
it's interesting. I wanted to ask you about some of the reaction to all of this. One particular case, there's a group called a very conservative group in Utah County called the Standard of Liberty. Mm-hmm. And it's a foundation, and they published this open letter on their website that got a lot of attention in the blogosphere, and it criticized certain professors, guest lecturers, and students themselves at Brigham Young University for what it called all manner of progressivism. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about social issues and economic issues, socialism, I think they mm-hmm. threw in there, but including this liberal attitude they regard anyway, Brigham Young University, towards homosexuality. The letter was written by the founders of this group, and they expressed this outrage toward the publicity department at BYU for saying that your firing wasn't because he was gay. And they were also angry with the student paper for removing this really stridently anti-gay letter from its website. Let me read some of this because I want to get your reaction to this. Is this homophobia, I guess, is the question. Mm-hmm. The gay activists continue their work and grow in boldness. Why aren't those who are obligated to stand for truth and righteousness at all times, in all things, and in all places vocal as well? At the very least, as things stand, you may want to think again about making that regular financial contribution to BYU. Mm-hmm. There's the letter that BYU is losing its standards because, in fact, it didn't just go out and say, as they didn't, mm-hmm. we fired Kendall Wilcox because he's immoral. Mm-hmm. He's a homosexual. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you make of that?
Again, I don't take it as homophobic. I don't think those people are necessarily afraid of homosexuals. They have a very particular, specific moral stance on the world, a worldview. And frankly, I see, a lot of people reacted sort of negatively to that and said, how dare they? And that's hurtful and so on. And I can see why. I'm not discounting those who were hurt by that. But I saw it as a great invitation for discussion. I don't shy away from their stance. In fact, I've invited them to participate in the film. Sadly, they declined and just said that if I wanted to know their views, it's on their website. And by the way, also their views are God's views. And in the end, they also said, because I explained I was looking for sort of multiple views on this to help everybody understand where other people are coming from, what's the history of their story. Right. And they said, you may think there's multiple views on this, but in the end, you'll find out there's only one.
It's God's.
Exactly. Yeah. Fair enough. That's where they're coming from. But I see this stance as helpful to a discussion because, for example, another quote from that open letter, which for me is probably the most salient point, which is most revelatory about who they are and what their thinking is. Is where they say that all these problems are rooted in, they actually sort of take it back to and sort of blame what they consider to be a far too liberal or progressive stance on the part of the church itself, which is that, the church says it's okay to be. Some people just are homosexual. We can't explain it. We don't understand why and so on and so on.
Which is kind of the official position.
Exactly. Yeah. We just say, law of chastity is such that you don't act on it.
Yeah.
This particular group and many, many other people that they reflect, their opinions and views say that stance alone, they actually call it soul killing is the word that they use, the soul killing policy of allowing homosexuality in principle but not in practice, which to me was sort of mind blowing because that is at the heart, right? That is at the heart of you could take it both ways. So for them, they're saying, why even allow that? So actually, they're saying, don't even allow it in principle. So, that's pointing towards reparative therapies, the power of the atonement to heal anything absolutely in this life. and that they're actually themselves saying, we got a problem here in this conundrum of allowing it in principle but not in practice.
So, Kendall, you refuse to be provoked, basically. I mean, even in the questions I'm asking you, you're really good at sort of taking them but trying to throw a proactive spin on them. And I don't mean that in a bad way.
Sure, sure.
But here you are now with this letter that somebody could – some could construe as not hateful, but certainly some would say it's ugly.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I see why.
And you see why. Right. There you are empathizing again. And you've even talked about empathizing for the people who let you go.
Absolutely.
So this is what it's about, right? It's you trying to how much self-control does that take, though, I guess? Because it seems like a lot.
Yes, absolutely. I am not the patron saint of empathy. I do not, I don't see myself.
You get
that
angry at times, right?
Absolutely. I get angry and I also get super depressed. I tend towards sort of thinking of the dark night of the soul, and I'm finding out more and more and more what that really is, what that feels like. But it's out of that darkness, that idea of Röttke, that in the darkness the eye begins to see. I'm leaning into that experience and at moments allowing the darkness just to pervade, and then at other moments finding some consciousness, some self-consciousness to say, what is this revealing for me? And I do, of the few things that I'm super committed to in my life right now and have clarity on, is the idea that I have to lean into and really try to understand and do the work of empathy. And find out what that means in a lived experience of a human experience, and just see what comes.
Because are you saying that's the essence of the problem? Is that people can't work through that anger that you're like, and that depression, that sense of depression, like, forget it, screw it. That's the essence in some ways of why people can't talk about all of this.
Exactly. Particularly those who experience homosexuality in the Mormon church, but also, again, empathizing for those who, in a sense, are on the other side of that equation, all the way from President Packer, who is considered too
pretty
conservative, right? Down to the family members of the individuals, or even those who have no family or friends who are gay. But we're all, in a sense, if we're engaged with our religious experience in the Mormon church right now, particularly this issue is one of the hottest issues, we're all confronted with it to one degree or another. And we all, in a sense, have to go through the experience of allowing the dissonance to bring on some sort of heartbreak almost, because we have what we believe to be absolutely true, and yet more and more we're finding evidences of human beings living the experience of homosexuality in the context of the church. Our mind and our heart starts to wrap itself around the dissonance that really presents, and it can cause, and in a sense, I use the word sort of, it breaks our hearts, because we begin to grieve, because anytime our assumptive world is challenged or changed, we have to grieve and sort through those emotions. And so, yeah.
Is this the Mormon in you in some ways that you have? It's like in some ways, this is a decidedly optimistic view of humankind, that if I can just bear through all of this, if I can listen to them and understand, not I'm going to change them, but I'm guessing somewhere down there there's a hope that there's going to be some kind of transformation, because things have got to give. Mm-hmm. And is that kind of a decidedly Mormon thing as well? Like this, I'm going to impose my spiritual sense of me, my faith, and I'm going to change the world.
Change the world. We'll see. But I do
That's
feel...
too grand. That's too grand.
That is the hope, at least this world that we're talking about right here, right now, and then give it a few years, and then we'll go off and conquer the rest of the world. But I do believe and also sort of hope that it does come from my Mormon experience, theological and lived experience within, being brought up in a household of faith, that it does come from instincts also centered in a theology based on redemption. That there is a falling, an experience of a falling, the darkness, the tensions that is inherent to this life experience, as far as I understand it, but that there is the power of redemption that can come by leaning ourselves into it, taking a break every once in a while because we have to, but leaning into it constantly, and we see what comes. We don't know.
You see this as an opportunity. You've put it this way: you want to reconcile the past with the present and future realities.
Mm-hmm.
But are people accepting the past as sad? You've recalled it a sad past. I mean, you know, are they acknowledging that there's mistakes that were made? Are you hearing that we had thought differently of that? I mean, this is an important question for Mormonism, because Mormonism, it's not unlike a lot of religious institutions where this idea of fallibility, it's very difficult for religious organizations to say, you know, we kind of blew it there in the past. They don't do it very well. And I think it's fair to say the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints doesn't do it very well. Absolutely. Or hasn't ever done it. That's a huge obstacle, it seems.
Or at least they don't do it. I don't know about the right, wrong, good and bad in terms of saying, you know, they've done a good or a bad job of it. Again, this may be overly empathizing, but, you know, because that pushes up against notions of truth and source and font of truth and how that plays and how that truth comes to us in this life, right? Vis-a-vis churches and our specific theological stance. And so it gets really difficult. I can understand it gets difficult to say, oh, we got it wrong. But then that begs the question, but then are
you
connected?
What else did you get wrong?
Yeah, what else did you get wrong? And what... Then it calls into question your genuine connection and affiliation with deity, which ultimately is the role and the presence of most you know, Christian churches, right, is to be that mouthpiece and the vehicle to God. And so I can understand why it's hard to say we got it wrong. The best they can do is just say, well, there's especially in our Mormon faith, which is one of its major tenets of ever unfolding, always opening up. That is the role and of the reason for having a living prophet, where we can grow and change. It's difficult. I understand completely. There's moments where I say, listen, if there is a God and this is his church and this is his mouthpiece, Thomas S. Monson could come out tomorrow and just say, we're good with the gays. Why doesn't he? I've been there. I go there sometimes.
Yeah.
But then I also find... it doesn't necessarily always work that way. It could. Blacks in the priesthood, very obvious example there. But even that took cultural trends and changes and individuals being introduced to other individuals and understanding their lived experience before changes happened.
See, the thing that I'm trying to understand is how it is that you conduct a conversation if you can't get some kind of acknowledgement on both sides. I'm not... That's suggesting there are just two, but let's just say, you know, there are for now. You know, on the part of the gay community or the, you know, the mainstream community, which is supporting gay rights, that they've been too quick to judge, for example. And then on the LDS side, you know, that they have to acknowledge. I mean, how do you further this conversation if you don't get people on both sides to say, all right, I'm going to be a little humble here and acknowledge I've made some mistakes. Can you move on if you don't get that?
Absolutely, but I think that can come organically through the emphasis on empathy.
Empathy, that's the word.
That's why I go there, right? Is because if you come at somebody saying, you absolutely have to apologize first, otherwise I don't want to know anything from you. I don't want to hear anything from you. I've had conversations about this, pretty heated and good constructive conversations, like people like Troy Williams, you know, here locally.
He's a local gay activist and radio producer.
Yeah.
Hosts a really good radio program.
Where he's saying, I'm out for justice, you know, recompense and so on. And I say, I don't take that away from you at all. We need to acknowledge the past, always, always have that eye to the past. But without real empathy, there's no real justice. You know, without each individual on, like you say, sort of both sides, doing the work to try to understand the history, the background, the feelings, the lived experiences of the individuals behind the rhetoric and behind the ideas, then we really don't know what we're talking about. It really is just rhetoric. It is just words we're throwing at each other. There's no depth behind it.
Kendall Wilcox is with us. His film project is called Far Between. He's also the founder of the Empathy First Initiative. You can find links to that, by the way, on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about his film project. He's been doing a lot of interviews, approaching 100 now?
Yeah.
We'll get to it when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Utah filmmaker Kendall Wilcox is joining us again. When he was first with us last summer, Wilcox was drawing attention for his situation. That is, he was an employee at Brigham Young University, had come out publicly as being gay. The idea was to create a dialogue about the LDS Church and homosexuality, but also along the way to create a film. Kendall Wilcox has been fired from his job. Today in the program, he's joining us to explain what happened and also give us an update on his documentary. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Okay, so the extent of this film so far, you've done 70-plus interviews now, headed towards 100. Are you starting to get some clarity, or does it just seem like mush right now?
Some definite themes that are emerging from interview to interview, and also a common thread of sort of a common typical story of what it's like to be homosexual and Mormon.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What is it?
Without, you know, I'm very, like, I pause there.
Yeah,
you know?
I noticed.
because I don't want to diminish in any way the specific idiosyncratic real differences in people's lives. But there are some major sort of signposts, mile markers, you know, in terms of as, you know, that can be just put down to sort of a human experience of when you are confronted by dissonance between faith and sexuality. There are some common sort of milestones along the way.
Like what?
The experience of the moment, for example, the moment when one, in a sense, can't
deny it anymore.
Yeah, and what that looks like and what that feels like, or what it's like for many people in their youth, where what we're finding which is very interesting, and not necessarily it's only specific to the Mormon experience, but maybe of an Orthodox community. Where in your youth, again, this is coming up in almost every interview, almost, I'd say maybe 85%, that the individuals actually have not made the connection, don't make the connection in their adolescence between their lived experience of, you know, sort of growing into sexuality, maturation, learning about human intimacy and their specific experience of it, and connecting it over to this thing called homosexuality. Huh. They don't make that connection. I know I didn't. You know, there's maybe an awareness of a lack of opposite sex attraction in sort of a curiosity, like, huh, why is – I get – it's a cultural norm for everybody to say she's hot, yeah. You know, but I don't really get it inside. That's strange. It'll come, you know, you yeah. sort of dismiss it. And a lot of that is because we, you know, within an Orthodox community like the Mormon community and culture, you know, there are no cultural cues or norms that help me process and understand the experience that I am having of attraction towards the same sex. You know, there are nobody else in Sunday school classes is saying, oh, he's so hot. Absolutely not. And let alone the more sort of subtle nuances of the experience. And so it's not until adulthood, until you sort of expand your horizons of understanding, that you start to make those connections, which I know some people would say, well, that's why we should stop talking about homosexuality, so people never make those connections. Obviously, I don't agree with that stance. Anyway, so that's a couple of the common threads.
Let me I want to play some tape. Some of the clips that you've pulled a few for us from all of this tape you're collecting. Let's start by talking about a man named Mike. That's not his actual name, but we'll call him Mike today. He is in what he calls, you call, a mixed orientation relationship. What is that?
Obviously, that is self-identified, because there are certain people that would have relationships that look and feel exactly the same, but they choose not to call it that. But for him, he is gay. He has come to a place in his life where he feels, without a doubt, I am attracted to members of the same sex, but yet he is married to a woman who is heterosexual, and so they are experiencing sort of a heterosexual, heteronormative marriage. They have three kids. They're well over a decade into it, and she's been aware all along. Yeah.
They got married. She knew that he was gay.
Yeah. Well,
he had same-sex tendencies.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, which at that time, again, sort of hearkening back to this idea of we don't have cultural cues within our community to understand this stuff, which is part of what's behind the agenda of Far Between, is to start people talking about so we can identify and understand these things early on. But they, you know, they get married in their early 20s.
But that's so interesting. It's because he didn't say, I'm gay. The sense wasn't that he was gay. The sense was that he had same-sex tendencies.
Which means vastly different things
exactly.
in our community. Yeah. And neither one of them were trained or had any information about what that meant.
Yeah.
No lived experiences or stories of other people.
No counseling from the church that will give them some perspective about that?
No. He did enter counseling eventually, but that's after the fact. So in the moment of getting married, she even confessed and shared with us that her father actually at the time tried to reproach her and say, we think your fiancé may be same-sex attracted. She felt it coming from him and literally fled the scene before he could get it out because she didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
But he did share that with her. He did say, this is something I experienced. But again, they were both, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, just so naive to the realities of what that means in a lived experience. He had no idea. She clearly had no idea. They thought, okay, we can work through this, which is the mantra of almost everybody that enters into these relationships
when it's disclosed
up front. We will work through it. We love each other. We have the gospel to hold us together, the church community and so on, and our faith. Why can't we do this?
But do they also say, and I do not at all intend to be facetious or crass about this, but do they ever get from their leaders, once you've had real sex, and I put that in quotes, heterosexual sex, then you'll know it was meant for you.
Yes. That's still pervasive, sadly, as a counsel. It's ebbed, at least in the research we're doing and the anecdotal stories we have. It's ebbed in terms of not every single ecclesiastical leader or counselor is saying, get married, have sex.
You'll be fine.
Your true heterosexuality will emerge. What we're finding actually is obviously much the opposite, actually. So many, again, these are good, chaste, sort of law, chastity abiding individuals enter into the relationship never having any real engagement with their own sexuality. And then they begin to have a sexual experience with their spouse and in a sense finally begin to get in touch with their experience of sexuality. And it isn't just about intercourse. It is about the full lived experience of intimacy, human intimacy in a committed, bonded relationship. And in those moments, it's actually in the process of engaging with their own sexuality in the context of a mixed orientation relationship that they start to go, wow. These are marked differences between my inclinations, my desires, my feelings, and what I am experiencing daily with this person who I love, but I don't fully love.
Yeah.
So
let me play a clip. What's striking about this moment in the film that you're creating, this conversation you have with him, is the question that you ask him that completely throws him off.
Exactly.
And I want to highlight that. You say to him, he's saying, I feel happy when I come home and my wife says hello or whatever it is, and you say, well, what if it were your husband?
Mm-hmm. Completely.
It completely discombobulates him. Let's play this first part of it and then his response to it.
Yeah.
We'll just call him Mike. This is from the film that Kendall Wilcox is putting together. It's called Far Between.
It's a mixed orientation marriage. Hmm. And I'm trying to take very slow steps so I don't do anything foolish. I'm trying not to be rash. Mm. But like I said, there are days when that's very much that I don't want to be married. Mm. But then there's other times when I'm coming home from work and I am very happy to be going home.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But if you were going home to your husband.
Um,
going on?
Well, he it was amazing in that he just the suggestion, the mere suggestion, with that silence, there is him crying, which you can't see but sort of hear.
Yeah.
And the expression just that pours across his face of him trying to, in a sense, fight the longing and desire he feels just at the mere suggestion, because it's in the face of what that means up against the realities of his marriage and how much he loves and is devoted to his wife and children. That dissonance right in that moment and the flip of the heart that happened between I'm happy to come home and it's a good thing and why would I give it up, to just the mere idea of coming home to a man that he loves and is committed to. That's what is at the heart of the film too, is some of those ineffables, the intangibles that are really sort of hard to explain, but when you see it come out of a human being, that's what the film's about.
It's hard because he doesn't want to be portrayed, as we'll hear in this another moment from this interview. He doesn't want to be portrayed as a victim.
Exactly.
As you'll hear him say, I entered into this. I was consciously aware of what I was doing. But then he's angry as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is he trapped? Is he trapped?
He fluctuates. Excuse me. He fluctuates in his feeling about.
You hear it in his clip.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so much ambivalence. Because he doesn't want to be a victim. Nobody really wants to feel themselves a victim, A. And then B, he wants to find a sense of power and volition because he is so overwhelmed by a sense of victimhood, without putting a word to it, but that feeling of, I don't know what to do. And I did get into this with, as you'll hear him say, the best of intentions, faith in ourselves, each other, our love, and so on. So, yeah.
It's like a bunch of things. It's anger. And it's loss. And it's desire. And it's just kind of collected into the perfect sonic wave to like bust. I'm angry that I'm in this position. I'm furious at the doctrine and the thought that got me to this point, and that again, I'm not a victim. I pursued it with full intent, complete conviction. But there came a point when I was engaging with some of these issues and I gained my own testimony and trying to become a better person, and I internalized and I had a testimony and I just plowed ahead with full conviction. So, I mean, yes, in some degrees I am a victim in the sense that I guess acted against my own interests.
When we come back from a break, I want to talk to you about that acting against their own interests. That seems a theme too.
Mm-hmm.
That
absolutely.
Not trusting their own instincts, not trusting.
Yep.
That's coming up a lot, it seems.
Oh, absolutely. That's a major theme that's coming up about, again, if the intent is to understand what is it like to be homosexual and Mormon. Fundamentally, it is to not trust and actually diminish, discourage, and try to eradicate one of the most basic instincts that we do have as human beings. And that can pervade into the rest of our lives and our psyche. So,
Kendall Wilcox with us. His film project that he's working on right now is called Far Between. He's also the founder of the Empathy First Initiative. You can find links to all of this on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Utah filmmaker Kendall Wilcox. We're talking a bit about, of course, the story that brings him here, part of the story anyway. He's been fired from his job at Brigham Young University. But now we're talking about the thing that sort of led him there in the first place to this position, I suppose, in some ways. And that is the work that he's doing for his documentary, trying to open a dialogue about Mormonism and homosexuality. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Jennifer is joining us. She's been waiting in Vernal, Utah. Jennifer, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I still have the leftovers from a cold. But I'm a convert to the church, and I did not like – everything was okay. Of course, I was very young. But the bit about the blacks and the priesthood was not working for me. This was in 1976. So I fasted and prayed and was told that it would be, was a problem, but that it would be resolved in the near future. And if you look at how many years after the Civil War that was, that's a lot of years. So I'm wondering if it's just the sheer slowness of human beings to just get it that is at issue here, and that eventually the church will issue some kind of a comment that says, oh, well, now we get it, so it's okay for you guys to be who you are. You know, I don't know if we'll hear it or not, but I'm wondering.
Yeah, it's a fair question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly will never pretend to speak for the church or speculate on forthcoming doctrine or doctrinal changes. That's completely out of my realm, thankfully. But I think that it speaks to, you know, one of the beauties and challenges of existing within the Mormon theology, that we do believe that God works through his prophets, that are human beings, which can be absolutely frustrating in times, unbelievably. But also there's beauty to it, because it does reflect a faith, if that's the word, on God's part in us to communicate with him, to wait upon him and have a genuine dialogue. We don't believe in the infallibility. I've never heard that term applied to the Mormon experience, infallibility.
You've never heard the term, but don't you hear it expressed in other ways?
Culturally, absolutely. I mean, there is the phrase, you know, when the brethren speak, the thinking's been done.
Yeah.
But I think there's a majority of the brethren that we could sit down with face to face that would say, absolutely not. Do not live your life like that. So I think we can all agree that's the reality.
Yeah. I guess that it seems to be what you're saying in some ways is also God said in 1978 to these pleas from these Mormon leaders, what were you waiting for? I didn't intend that in the first place. Are you thinking that's what's going on now, that maybe church leaders are not listening entirely to God, who's saying, what are you talking about excluding gay people?
Again, can't speak for their experience or what their intentions are, motivations. I do wonder, and I'm hoping eventually to have a conversation with one of the brethren for this film. I've put my intentions out there. We'll see what comes. But that is one of the most fundamental questions I would like to be able to ask, genuinely ask, is, are they even asking? You know, in reading the history example, if we're going to bring an analog to the blacks and the priesthood experience, you know, reading about David O. McKay, from David McKay forward, in terms of that issue and the experiences of those individuals, and especially the book David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, how it's vividly played out there. Ultimately, it came down to a question: are they asking God? You know, were they talking to God and saying, should we change this? What do you want us to do here? And that's my question today.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I'm not sure if they are. And that's okay. But I would love to find out, are they asking? You know, are they genuinely pleading with God and saying, help us understand? Because the lived experience of people that we're hearing more and more and more from, particularly, you know, hopefully through this project, isn't coinciding with much of what we feel. Are they presenting that dissonance to God? I believe some of them are and have, and it's yielded certain answers that may be unpleasant, but there it is. So we'll see.
We were talking earlier about this kind of sense that you're seeing among people to sort of deny these basic this basic instinct, mm-hmm. and they don't trust them anymore because that doesn't line up with where they figure they're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. There's a woman named Lori. I'm not sure if this is her actual name.
It is.
Okay, Lori here. Let me have you talk about this because I want to play this. Because you talk about what the effects of suppressing all of these feelings and all of these instincts mm-hmm. makes you distrust that. Mm-hmm. And it has, you say, this deep effect on – and not just on their spirituality but on their lives, on their career choices.
Absolutely. And this isn't the same for everyone, so I'll say that up front. But that is one of the major themes that we're finding. And I know in my own lived experience it sort of coincides, and hopefully I'm not projecting onto everybody else. But and this is one of the most important things I think maybe at this stage of our research and filming that we can convey to a general audience who really genuinely, out of no malfeasance of their own, don't get it. They don't understand the lived experience of being gay and Mormon. Where if you learn over years through cultural messages, doctrinal messages, and internalize it to such a degree that you suppress, not only just suppress, you learn to absolutely hate a fundamental instinct that comes up hundreds of times a day in little subtle ways. And it's not just sex. I want to say that it's not just, looking at somebody and wanting to have sexual intercourse with them. It's intimacy. It's the desire and longing for connection that comes up on so many instinctual levels. But every time, try to imagine, every time if you're a highly conscientious Mormon, every time that comes up, you recognize it, you're hypervigilant of it, and you cast it out, you castigate it and say, no, that is wrong. That actually bleeds into your self-ideation. That's because it's so inextricable to where you are inside that you begin to say, my basic, who I am is tainted. And that can pervade into everything. Then you start to say, I don't know if I can trust any of my instincts.
Here's Lori from the collection of interviews that Kendall Wilcox is putting together for his film project. It's called Far Between.
At one point, I had tried so hard to stop feeling the way I felt. And there was this one girl at the time that I was just so in love with. And we were really close friends. But I was so worried that I was going to do something that would just damn me forever, and I felt that it would have been better to not be alive at all than to do that, to so much as hug her the wrong way. I felt it would be damning me and corrupting her, and she was just so sweet and perfect, and so I planned to just end it all.
There's this element of the film that's going to be somewhat controversial to some people in the gay community, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. Or at least you don't have a film yet, so I shouldn't say that. But I mean, there is this part where some of the people you've talked to have expressed support for or defense of so-called reparative therapies. And I want to play a clip from one woman who went through this process and speaks in defense of it.
Absolutely.
Does that make you uneasy?
At the very, very outset, I thought, maybe a little. But I knew that I absolutely have to engage with this. This is part of the whole story. And I have respect for these individuals more and more now that I am speaking to them directly. It's highly criticized. People on that sort of side of the equation are highly defensive because they're so criticized. But it has to be spoken to, and I have to allow them to describe their experiences. So she's a great example.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about this is that she's chosen to remain faithful,
mm-hmm.
and still she feels like she's not being accepted.
And not enough, yeah.
It's not enough.
And my heart went out to her. I had no idea that, because here she is saying, I am, she broke up with the love of her life, the woman that she said that she couldn't figure out how to stop loving her. And she broke up with her, broke her heart to be faithful to the church. And then she describes here how you don't get casseroles for that.
It's not recognized, and it's not, you don't get encouragement in the church of, wow, nice job.
Right.
We're so glad you're not in that lesbian relationship anymore. You did so good. We're going to bring over dinner and say congratulations. And Same with the pain, though. I remember thinking, you know, a gentleman got paralyzed from the neck down, and, you know, all this outpouring of care and concern, and it happened at the same time I was breaking up with Tracy. And I thought, I hurt as bad as he does.
Absolutely.
I know I do. And there's nothing. Not only is there nothing, if I told them,
right, it
would probably be bad.
That's what you had mentioned before, which totally was a paradigm shift for me in terms of understanding what the experience of somebody like you being faithful to the church and
still not accepted, right?
Yeah.
Right. I had the first people I told was a Relief Society president that the bishop had brought in, mm-hmm. and that made a huge difference. She was a great friend, and one other friend that I told during that time, and that was really helpful. I didn't tell anybody on my next move. Then when I started working on the book, mm-hmm. feelings started coming up. I thought, I need some support.
Yeah.
So I told a friend of mine. I said, you know, hey, I used to be involved in this relationship with a woman. I used to be interested in women, but, you know, now I'm in the gospel, and I'm writing this book, and mm-hmm. I'd been through the temple even. And she's the one that said, she said, that's sick. And I can still feel that.
Kendall, let me ask you this, though. You went to a reparative therapy camp, and you had this ethical dilemma come over you. We don't have a lot of time, sure. but I want to hear you tell that story.
The ethical dilemma came in going into the camp, which was fully disclosed to the camp leaders, who I was, what I was about, and that I both was taking it as a personal step to really try to engage with the principles, philosophies, methodologies to see if it could help me in understanding myself better and my experience of sexuality, but then also to understand their methodologies and also to, again, as a window into the hearts and minds of people going through this. When I got there, I was overwhelmed with the rawness of the fellow journeyers, as they're called in this particular camp, overwhelmed by the vulnerability and the uncertainty.
Which resonated with you. You sensed that, of course.
Yes, yes. But it also sort of reminded me, I've made a little progress on my journey. But they were highly vulnerable, so disconnected from themselves and understanding and feeling comfortable, again, trusting their instincts to process their life experiences, that it was astounding to me. But then I found that I became increasingly uncomfortable because here they are in this ultra-vulnerable place, and here's well-intentioned, I absolutely believe, well-intentioned individuals trying to, in a sense, replace the personal narratives that these people have, which may be damaged, may be faulty, but replace it with a whole new narrative with its own agenda. That didn't really, in the end, address this vulnerability first and foremost and allow the individuals to come into a place of full self-consciousness of their lived experience. And then let's talk about alternative narratives about making meaning about our lives. So I found that to be personally unethical, and I actually had to speak to the director and say, here's my ethical dilemma. I feel like I have to speak up. I can't just sit here anymore. But I know that I don't want to be disruptive. I'm not here to be a jerk. But this is an ethical dilemma. What do you want me to do? I could stay or I can leave. And I know that if I leave, it could cause some insecurities on the part of people saying, well, wait, he's leaving. What does that say about us? You know. Yeah. So I didn't want to sort of disrupt it. I left the issue to him. He said, leave. Yeah. So I did. But now it also comes in this new ethical territory of how do I discuss that like we're doing right here now in a way that is respectful of the individuals who, frankly, there are many individuals who find this very particular specific journey into manhood is what it's called. They find this experience to be sacred because through those experiences, they have built their own sort of sense of identity, sexual identity, lived identity, and also their sort of marital status is all based on principles they've learned and have lived through that. So how do I respect that as sacred for them? I can see why they call it sacred and yet have my experience of it and my analysis and saying so much of it is faulty.
You've talked about how you see that things are getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked about this litany, which we don't have a lot of time to go through, must make you feel pleased. I mean, there's this club at BYU for LGBT students, which you've talked about being thriving. There's this It Gets Better video campaign that you're helping to produce for the Mormon community. Mm-hmm. There's this group Affirmation that held this annual meeting in Kirtland, Ohio, and it's the first time this group of openly gay Latter-day Saints met at this historic Mormon site. I mean, there's all these things that you're seeing developing. Mm-hmm. And now you're not employed at BYU. I'm wondering, mm-hmm. How are you feeling about all of that? Hopeful, discouraged about that fact, I suppose, but free in some way?
About the BYU?
Yeah.
Sure, free. I have a little more spare time, which is already completely filled up. But overall, completely optimistic. Yeah. Again, there's moments of a personal discouragement because, again, this is my own journey. I don't know how it's going to end. There are moments of that dissonance feels like an impasse again. But then there's moments where I push through that. And I don't just suppress it. I push into it and through it. But overall, you look at all these evidences, you just the litany, and you see things are getting better. They are changing. Our culture, our community is finding ways to engage around this in more productive, healthy ways. It's a great thing. Great time to be gay and Mormon.
Kendall Wilcox. His film project is called Far Between. He's also the founder of the Empathy First Initiative. You can find links to all of that on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. Kendall, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.